Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart. And we are going to talk to my friend, Garrett Jones, no relation. He works with Peter Eliades of Stock Market Cycles Management, Inc. He is one of the foremost experts on technical analysis and also the long wave economic cycle. This is a fascinating interview. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. I think you're going to learn a lot. Here we go.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Garrett, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Linda.
I know that you typically follow cycles for a particular part of the year, is that right? And then are out of the market for a particular part of the year, according to how this has worked successfully over the years. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Let's say kind of right.
Okay.
Basically, looking at cycles is we live on a planet of cycles. In fact, I always have said we live on a planet of cycles and a planet of duality. Rich, poor, black, white, arid, wet, everything on this planet is, we're constantly in the process of going from one extreme to the other. So we go from a depression to a boom, back to a depression. We go from lows to highs, etc. And that's really what cycles are. All a cycle is a picture of duality, you know, where you're, and this planet is full of cycles, and our species does a marvelous job of defining everything else's cycle. I mean, certain people in the scientific area can tell you when the whales are coming by Monterey, California, and when the swallows fly to Capistrano, but they're not so good at telling us when the market's going to top. And that's what we've done, is we've taken a look to analyze or analyze correctly, but the awareness of the cycle and the magnitude of the cycle is very important because it defines your risk. On a shorter term basis, you have any given year, and you've heard the phrase sell in May and go away. That comes from just an observation that the market generally bottoms in the fall. We know lots of Octobers where the markets declined and you've had bottoms. And frankly, in 2007, you had a top in October. But in most cases, you'll have a bottom in that time. And like I've said, you know, buy low and sell high. If you buy those bottoms, the history, the general cyclicality is that the market goes up from that time period, October, November into May. And then from May to October, you're really not getting much action. So the way you do that is you go back to the, you know, as far as you can, as far as is data collection, and you see how that's worked out. And the bottom line is the movement in the market has basically been from that period of October to May, and from May to October, generally, it's been flat to down. So that's a generalization with respect to cycles. Now, what Peter and I have done is we've taken a look, and by the way, the fourth quarter of the year, and then you can break it down into quarters, and there you're looking at monthly input. The fourth quarter of the year is unique because it's the only quarter of the year where each of the months historically have a positive return. And people would think, well, gosh, that doesn't sound right, because we know that lots of lows have happened in October. You know, October of 74 was a low. October of 87 was a crash. Gosh, how can that doesn't sound right? How can that be? And I go, well, remember, you're right. You do have that low in October. But if October isn't over, what's happening from that low? You're shooting up through the remainder of the month. So that's what happens in that rebound. It comes off a massive low, has made October a positive month. November is a positive month, and December is a real positive month. What we did is we broke down the months going back as far as we could, and that took us into the 1920s. And we found, in fact, a guy named Norm Fosbeck. He did his study into 1975 from, I believe, 1928. And he took 5 days of every month. He took the last day of the month and the first 4 days of the new month. By and large, you can take every other day. And he did a comparison. He said, if I put $10,000, irrespective of taxes and anything else, and in, I believe it was December of 1928, if I put $10,000, and I only invest in those 5 days, the last day of every month, the first four trading days, this is trading days, of the next month, and then I pull out of the market, and then I keep a fund, and the other fund has over three times as many days. In other words, you're dealing with 5 days. There's about 22 trading days in a month. So you've got 21, 22 days. So you've got, you know, at least 16, 17 days versus 5 days. And here's what happened. The 10,000 grew. It grew to 572,000 over that time period. And the other days where you had three times as many days, that $10,000 dropped down to $900.
Wow.
There was a gentleman who wrote a book about the market being random. And I went up and he was a Harvard grad or whatever. Lots of people have written books on random markets. But I was speaking at the conference and he was too. This is many years ago. And I won't use his name, but we were talking, and I said, "You really believe in that?" And so, yeah, the market's definitely random. You know, we know that. Blah blah blah. You know how those Ivy Tower folks are. Anyway, I said, "Well, that's interesting." I said, "You got probably some better computers back there than I do." But I said, "I'll make a little exercise with you." I said, "You know, there's about 21, 22 days a month." And I said, "Listen, I just want 5 of those days every month. And I want to give you the other days. You'll have better than three times what I have. So if it's random, by definition, if it's random, you should outperform me 3-1, and you're starting to get uncomfortable." He said, "This guy knows something." But anyway, I gave him the number. I said, "Listen, I'll give you the book that was written in, and you can check it out for yourself and run it on your own computers. You'll find out that that's true." So I said, "One thing for darn sure, the market is not random." I said, "Whether you or I or anybody else can define it and do successful market timing is another question, but it's definitely not random." So
so did you do the comparison, and did he agree, or how did that turn out?
I think he didn't want to continue that conversation. And my guess, though, if he's a good analyst. Good analysts go back and do their analysis, and I'm sure that he found anybody can do it. Anybody who knows how to write a program can do that and figure it out for themselves. That's in fact true. And what we did is we went back and did that study ourselves, and we found out that it was true. But what we did is this tells you on a monthly basis. Now, what happens? We were curious as to whether there was a difference between the respective months. You know, are all months the same? Mm-hmm. You know, isn't the argument if it's random, random ought to be really random. So why should May be the same as December? And we found out that they're not the same. We found out that end of the month and beginning of the new month obviously worked in all months. I mean, because it was over such a long period of time. His study ended in 75, and we did a study from 75 to the present and found that for a lot of that time, it actually was better. Sometimes when you study things like that, they lose validity, just over time. But we found that they got better. So anyway, we did our own analysis, which was really tedious. And we defined various periods with respect to each month. And some of the months, such as September, for example, are real short. It's good in the beginning of the month because you have Labor Day and the market's usually good into Labor Day. But after that, generally the market's going down. And then the end of the month, frequently we're just not in at all. So it's a short month. But December, or in bull or bear market years, is a very good month. And we found that in December, 3 weeks of the month of December are good. The second week after the first week into the middle of the month is the 1 week that we'd be out. But other than that, we're invested throughout December. And even in 2008, 2008 was horrendous into October and also into November. And December was a good month. Then it dropped down in January of 2009. down to the low ultimately in March. But December was a good month. So we've defined that and utilized it. And what's kind of nice is I think if somebody can find a way, I mean, to be invested all the time, if you're coming into a period like we are now, could the market continue to go up and make you a lot of money for a while? Yes. But we're ending another 40-year cycle, which is actually part of an 80-year cycle and arguably a 240-year cycle, which is almost beyond our comprehension. But all these things are coming together now, and that means that the risk is really at a maximum. So you don't you need to have something that you do that takes into consideration the level of risk, because this is obviously a much different time than going back to 2009 at the bottom, and particularly going back to, say, the low of 1974. I mean, you could have invested then and gone away on a five-year vacation and been just fine. That's not something you want to do right now, probably.
Yeah, and, but how can people really protect themselves now? I mean, how can the average investor, I know you as a professional and as a money manager can do that, but how can the average person do that?
Remember to always have a reason to be invested. I've done something recently because of where I think we are in the cycle. I've been testing for about 35 years, actually, and we put it to use in the last couple of years. And we are not in the market. Our home base is being out of the market, and we need a reason to get back in. And what we've done, I mean, I'll just give you an example. What we've done is we monitor about 1,000 of the most liquid stocks and maybe 100 of the most liquid indexes and ETFs. And what we're looking for is extremes. We use their own price and we use an algorithm and so forth. But when a stock or an ETF gets way out of its normal range based on its own price, for example, really overbought. Take a Goldman Sachs. Look at a Goldman Sachs chart or any of those financials. They're really stretched out on the upside now. And we've defined something where when it gets that stretched out and it meets certain parameters, then we step in and play it in the opposite direction. So we've got the benefit. We've got the odds highly in our favor. Based on the own on its own history, the fact is it's already moved monumentally in one direction. So it's like taking a slingshot or a rubber band and really stretching it out. And we move in. We're doing market timing is hard enough. What we're doing is we're anticipating a turn. Most people are trend followers. You wait for the trend to start, then you jump on the trend. We're doing something a lot more difficult. That's hard enough to do, particularly in this market, because you have a trend that lasts for what, Linda? Day or two lately?
Mm-hmm. unless it's the VIX being very controlled and very flat. I mean, we've seen some of the craziest markets this last year.
Exactly. I mean, in this year, 2016, I mean, if somebody were to ask me, gee, you've studied the market, and even in times before you were alive, what would you say is the wildest year, and I would say 2016. And to us living through it, it doesn't seem that wild, but the first quarter of the year, you had the most volatility in the last 78 years, going back to 1937. And in the last quarter, the third quarter, you had the least volatility in the history of the market. So in the same year, the most and least, then you have the most contentious and most polarized election that I ever remember in the same year, and the year isn't over yet. Who knows who knows what's next? We're in a very incredible time.
Well, Garrett, as always, you've been fabulous and fascinating. How can people reach you if they want more information from you?
I guess I'm an old fashioned guy. The phone number and email is what I would suggest. The basic phone number for me is area code 925-820-0161. And my personal email is Garrett, GARRETT, two R's and two T's, 111@comcast.net.
All right. Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Linda, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Welcome back to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm so excited to have our co-host with me, Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds. How are you, Miranda?
I'm doing really well. I'm back from New Orleans and ready to party. Although I am sad that I missed last week. It sounded like a lot of fun.
Yes, and we missed you too. We did. And Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt and Rich is a King.
How you doing, Linda and Miranda? I am in New York right now, checking out the cold weather and the beautiful fall.
Oh, that's fantastic. Today we're missing Mr. Joe Salcihi. I'm so sorry he's not with us. But who's going to start a rumor of where he is?
I was thinking something, but I couldn't do it on public radio, so I'll just drop it.
I'm just so uncreative today. I don't have it for you.
Well, we could say he got arrested or something. That might be interesting. Okay, well, we won't go down that road then. So we have this interesting interview with Garrett Jones. What did you make of the unique volatility and the lack thereof this year, Doug? What did you think about what he said about how it's been just crazy and then calm as a glass mirror?
So I think that the less, first off, without, you know, really studying the numbers, it's hard to know, but assuming that the numbers actually bear that out as being true, I think the interesting lesson is that people don't necessarily feel what's going on in the market. A lot of people are like, well, my gut tells me. And this is a good example where you shouldn't trust your gut, because if you ask people, well, how's the market been? They'd be go, oh my gosh, it's so volatile, because of, not necessarily because of the actual levels of the market, but maybe it's because of what's going on in politics or in other economic issues not related to the market. And so the lesson that I drew from this is look at the numbers and don't trust your gut.
Okay. Interesting, because I trust my gut a lot. So that's a hard one for me.
I can trust your gut, too. I just meant my own gut. I mean, if you spill your guts, I'll be happy to listen.
All right, Miranda, what are your thoughts about the volatility of the market this year and then the calmness?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. There was a bit of volatility around the Brexit and then very, very short-lived freak out during the recent election. I remember because I was watching the Dow futures at the time when it looked like President-elect Trump was going to be the president-elect, and they dropped like hundreds of points, the futures did. But by the next morning, everything was cool and opened and just, you know, went through. And since then, the market's been relatively stable. So it's been kind of interesting. It hasn't been quite the wild ride we'd expected. And I am kind of sad about that because now I'm still sitting on my VIX, just waiting. But we'll see what happens later. But yeah, it's been a little bit unusual. And I think that this just sort of proves that none of us can predict the market. None of us knows what's going to happen next. And one of the best things you can do for yourself is index, because it always goes back to indexing for me.
Isn't it funny how people come up with different conclusions? Because that's exactly the opposite of what Garrett Jones said.
I know, right?
I'm on Miranda's side on this one, which is, of course, always a shock, you know, for me to be with her.
I think that works really well. I mean, like, Linda's done an amazing job doing the trends and the cycles, and that's perfectly awesome if you can do that. But, you know, I'm sort of a boring person. I don't care for, you know.
I'm so agreeing with you on everything you say, Miranda.
That I'm totally boring, right? And I like this whole idea of calculated, like, if I'm going to take a risk, it's going to be very calculated, and the riskiest I can get is on the downtimes, maybe buying a few more extra shares of my index fund. And that's just sort of the way it works for me. So in times like this, when I don't know what's well, it doesn't matter whether I know what's happening or not, I'm still going to index. And I think it goes back to your own personal style and what you can handle.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I look at what has gone on with interest rates this year, I think that's really the telling story. And I think the Fed raising rates in December of last year was sort of the bottom of this declining interest rate cycle that we've had. And then it's a massive shift in another direction. And I think that caused a lot of volatility that we saw into February, that was, everything was just going crazy. And then for the rest of the year, it was like the Fed kept threatening to raise rates, but then they really put everything on hold until after the election. And so things just, you know, suddenly got very calm and there wasn't any volatility and the VIX didn't move at all. And it was almost like the strangest combination in 1 year to have, you know, this massive volatility and then just nothing. So I think a lot of that was just you know, underlying from the bond market, in my opinion.
Linda, can I ask you a question about this? Because you can be the proxy for Garrett, because you got to speak to him. And I'm trying to understand one of the things, sure. One of the concept cycles that he spoke about was over hundreds of years. And, you know, I'm very, very skeptical of people who look at these sort of long-term cycles, because I think that with anything, you can always do retrospective studies, kind of try to pick what you want to look at. And so I'm a little bit, I'm skeptical, let's say like that. And one of the other reasons, I think one of the cycles mentioned was like a multi-hundred-year cycle. And when you look at how the economy has been over time, you know, in the 1700s, which I guess is, you know, 100 years ago, the economy was 95% agriculture. It was nothing at all whatsoever like it is today. We went through, you know, agriculture and then the Industrial Revolution, which is nothing like it is today. You know, now we're kind of like in the information age. How can you really look back at what happened a long time ago and say, oh, that's the type of thing that's going to repeat itself?
Well, because people have looked back and found that there are things that repeat, and that's where the whole philosophy about cycles emerge, is from people noticing that things kept repeating. And it comes, you know, I mean, nobody, you know, disputes that days happen or seasons happen or anything like that, but there's actually 4,200 cycles that have been identified on planet Earth, and it's just something that we're not taught. And so people have researched that even into the stock market and found that there's truth in cycles that repeat in the stock market.
I'm not saying that you, obviously we learn from our experiences, and again, Garrett spoke about whales and stuff, which I have no familiarity with, but you know, this is very opposite from what the guy we talk about all the time, Warren Buffett, would talk about. You know, he would say, listen, you're buying a company because it has earnings, and we certainly know that the return of the S&P 500 is super correlated with the underlying earnings of companies. So if we assume that companies will be earning more over time, that's a reason to invest in the stock market, and not because, you know, it's May or November and you should buy and sell in May, buy in May and sell in November.
Right, but there's also a lot of trends in terms of what the economy is doing, so that groups of companies tend to do better or worse. So, for example, we've seen 6 quarters of declining profits in companies. So they tend to move together. And in fact, the way that cycles were determined or discovered was after the 1929 crash, the president wanted to know what was the cause. And after a lot of research was done, it came back that it was part of a cycle that happened on a regular basis. And so we see things move together, and we see not only, you know, we see companies move together, we see groups of companies move together. Right now we're seeing small caps move together. So you see it in the markets, it's just called different things and we look at it in a different way, but that's basically all it is. So why do you think the smart money is underperforming now, Miranda? Do you have any sense of why would some of the big hedge funds and such not be able to have performance right now?
I think a lot of it has to go back to the idea that we think we know what's going on when we don't, or sometimes because the market behaves in unexpected ways, in ways we haven't seen before, or ways that don't keep in line with our narrative. So when it became evident that President-elect Trump was going to be the president-elect and the Dow futures dropped all those points, it was based on a reaction to similar to, well, this is what happened during the Brexit and this is what's going to happen when Trump gets the nod. Then it flipped, then it changed. The next morning, things were relatively normal and things went forward, and now we're still moving in our bull market. And people are confused about why that would be, or they've come up with their own narrative of why that would be. And I think part of the reason there too is we might be moving into territory that is new. We talk about historically, this hasn't happened, or historically that hasn't happened. Well, there's a first time for everything, and we might be moving into a situation that's relatively new. And this also reminds me of back a few years ago, shortly after the financial crisis of 2008, when gold and the dollar were moving together for a period of time. And everybody was kind of weirded out by that, because normally gold and the dollar move inversely to each other. And all of a sudden they were moving together and they were correlating very well. And so we hit these points where things don't happen the way we expect them to. And so I think right now the smart money expected things to happen a certain way or expect the markets to react a certain way to certain news, and it's not happening the way they thought. And who knows if it'll shake out later and things will go back to what we call the normal, or, you know, maybe there's a new normal, as Bill Goss said a few years ago. It's just been a very interesting few years of turmoil and changes and things and shifts. And part of that has to do with, you know, more ordinary people have access to investing now. More of us are out there doing things with all of these new tools, and things aren't happening the way we expect them to happen. And I just think there's a lot going on right now, and I think we need a period of adjustment. And I think the smart money is going to need a period of adjustment as well.
I got some good points there. Doug, what do you think?
So I'm kind of questioning this whole concept of smart money. Not that the guys who run hedge funds aren't smart, because the fact is, I know many of them, or a lot of them, and they really are very bright. But I think one of the issues is that people become too smart for their own good. And they're constantly looking for some model that's going to make them more and more money. And whether it's looking at cycles or looking at earnings or certain ratios, and people will trade on that. And the question I think that a reasonable person would ask is, okay, fine, so you've developed some system, you see cycles, whatever your model is, and you've back-tested it, so you're pretty confident in it, you know, and if hopefully you've been doing this for a while, it means that you actually got to put your money where your mouth is. So if you really are smart money, how much money have you made on your own investing? I'm not talking about fees you took from clients. I'm talking about actually you invested and you were right more than once. I think that's what we have to look at, and I'm betting that except for the occasional black swan, we probably don't see any of these hedge fund managers really doing great. Because I think that people are getting away from a lot of the real fundamentals about what investing truly means, which means actually ownership in a company and counting on future earnings.
But when you're putting your clients' money with money managers, I mean, you're picking people who have a style and a discipline, right?
Yeah, so I'm not looking for people who have, I guess what I would call some kind of trick. You know, oh, we figured out the magic solution. I'm looking for money managers who I think are responsible, who are diversified, who they may look for certain signals in the market that they'll trade on, but they aren't really trying to outsmart the market on a regular basis. And I'll tell you, one of the tests you can use, or I think one of the questions you can ask when someone says that he's got some sort of, you know, magic crystal ball here, is that if you're looking at specific trends, you don't necessarily have to, you know, find someone who says, well, come back to me in 10 years and you'll see how smart I was. Because presumably, if you're looking for a trend or some sort of technical analysis, you could just speed up your trading or leverage your trading so that you could prove your point in a much shorter period of time. So for example, if you say, well, you know, a simple trend would be if the market goes up 2 points in a row, then I think that on the third point, it's going to go up again. That, let's just say that was some. So instead of having to test that, you know, once a year, and you say, okay, next year it's going to go up again because it went up the past 2 years, you could say, why don't you just trade this every minute, because there's tons of information in the market. And these sort of trends, I think, don't always prove themselves. And the reason that people find the trends a lot of times, they look at specific periods of time, and maybe those trends only work in specific models looking backwards and may not work looking forwards. So, sorry, that was the long answer to your question, which is, I'm not looking for someone who's got a crystal ball, but rather someone who's a responsible investor.
No, but I mean, you're looking for people that are outperforming the markets because you're putting your people with the best money managers out there, right? So you're looking for good performance, are you not?
I think there are two ways that you improve a portfolio. One is by performance, and one of them is by risk control. And so if there are managers who can combine both or stress one over the other, depending on what the client's needs are, that's where I would focus.
Mm-hmm. I think the markets have really gone from volatile, you know, this year with the, like we said, the beginning, where the money managers might have been able to function in that volatility and might have been able to go short and use some of their different strategies. And then we went to this calm period where they couldn't really do anything. I mean, all they could do is maybe try to be in a dividend stock that might pay them a higher dividend to try and do something to, you know, get a higher return during that time and get some alpha, get some outperformance over the market. But they really, you know, they had two opposite things going on this year, and I think that's what's made it difficult for a lot of smart money managers and certainly hedge fund managers who have to be outperforming in order to charge the enormous fees that they charge their clients. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to get away with that. But, you know, it's been an interesting time for them. And I think the time is coming where a lot of those funds are going to have to close because the enormous fees that they charge are not going to be tolerated by the clients who expect outperformance. And if they can outperform, then they're going to go and find some other money manager. So I think we're going to see possibly some very large hedge funds close toward the end of the year.
I think we've seen that in the past. It wouldn't be a new thing. That's something that...
No, it wouldn't be a new thing. I just think...
You do see them sort of coming off the table over time.
Yeah, but I think we have so many that are underperforming right now. If you go to Barron's and you look at all of the hedge fund managers that are underperforming, it is scary how many are in negative this year. And people are not going to tolerate paying those fees. Well, you know, they will credit back some fees and change the rules because they're losing money. But there's so many hedge funds losing money that I think we're going to have a massive closing of some hedge funds probably in the first quarter after the end of the year when people can redeem some cash and some shares. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that all turns out.
And this is...
That's
this
one
is
of the reasons, right, by the way, what you said.
I was just going to say, this is why you go with lazy money with indexing.
Right.
Just, who cares about smart money? Let's keep with the lazy money.
And it's also more liquid.
Yeah.
I just want to say, when you buy a hedge fund, I don't invest in hedge funds because, I mean, for any number of reasons, including the ones you said. But one of them, which is so important, is that who wants to put his money into something that you can't get your money out of, right? You have to wait till the end of the quarter or the end of the 6 months. And if you actually read the prospectuses for a lot of these things, they have a prospectus, it gives the fund the ability to even delay liquidation for longer. So this idea that you're getting some sort of exclusive investment pool is something that you really have to be careful about, because the day you need the money and they say, okay, wait 6 months, you may be really shocked.
I agree. And, you know, it's just interesting, though, that a lot of very, very wealthy people, that's where they're investing. And they have shifted a large part of their portfolio to that. So it's really interesting because that's, you know, that's just, it was a huge trend. I wonder if the trend is going to go the other way and people are going to be moving their money out of those kinds of hedge funds. So what kind of sectors do you like now, Miranda? Is there anything exciting that's looking good to you, or just kind of straight S&P, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, pretty much just straight S&P, you know, looking once again. I do have a fund with Dividend Aristocrats. And so just keeping with that, where, you know, I'm going to get the dividends from those probably, and just making sure that that things just kind of keep it moving. I mean, it is really boring, and I wish I could be like, hey, let's get some sectors. I think something to watch, I don't know how it's going to do, but I think something to watch over the next few months will be the healthcare sector, because there is a lot of uncertainty around what happens now with the Affordable Care Act. Now that the president-elect is a Republican who has vowed to get rid of it, and now that Congress is entirely controlled by Republicans who have been trying to get rid of it for years now. So I think that one of the interesting sectors to watch, like I said, I'm not sure, I'm not going to predict which way it's going to go, but one of the interesting sectors to watch might be the healthcare sector, just because of all of the uncertainty surrounding the Affordable Care Act in the coming months.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. There's certainly a lot of changes happening there, and that's probably a good one to keep an eye on. What do you think, Doug?
On that note, I think that when you look in, you know, certainly in pharmaceuticals, whether they will, now that they feel a little freer, they're not going to be restricted by the government in terms of earnings, possibly, that could be a positive area. Again, just to look at, who knows, you know, Trump has no real political experience, so whether he'll actually be able to implement them is a good question, which then leads you to, you know, other areas that could be affected by the new presidency, not the least of which would be something like Mexico, which doesn't seem to be on the number one list for Trump. And as we saw that, because like the Mexico ETFs, they got crushed right after election results. But what does that mean? Does it mean they're going out of business? Or is it possible that this is something people should be looking more closely at? I certainly wouldn't recommend it for someone who doesn't have a lot of tolerance for risk. But, you know, for people who like researching things, that would be a sector I would start researching to see if there's any particular areas that could actually profit from a new administration.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying with Mexico that maybe that's just a temporary decline that might be a good buying opportunity? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe I'm more optimistic than other people, but I think, you know, I don't think this is going to be some war that the United States is going to have with Mexico. It's going to end up with, you know, a wall paid for by the Mexicans. I don't know what it's going to end up being, but I think that Trump prides himself more in making deals. And if he is able to come up with some sort of deal that, you know, a deal has to be good for both sides of the equation. A deal where one side completely crushes the other one, you know, like in the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, which likely led to World War II, doesn't really help people. So in the same way, if you're trying to have a if you're trying to develop with another country that you don't agree with, just crushing them is not going to help anyone. But finding a compromise, which for Mexico would be phenomenal if they could work something out with Trump. And I think he's a negotiator. I think he'll look for a deal that's going to benefit everyone.
Well, we hope so. Well, I'm a fan of traditional asset allocation in terms of small cap, mid cap, large cap, growth and value. And, you know, small caps are...
But not bonds, right?
Well, not currently. I'm not a big fan of bonds. Not a big fan of bonds currently.
You only changed your mind since 2 weeks ago.
No, not a big fan of bonds only because of where interest rates are and what and the trend is in interest rates. I don't think that's going to be helpful for a lot of people. But I do think that small caps, which are a market cap of $250 million to $2 billion, are definitely outperforming, at least through the end of October. Small cap value is up 12.28%. The small cap 600 value, the small cap 400 value is up 12.83 versus the S&P's up
5.87.
Yeah, through the end of October, year to date. Yeah.
Don't small caps generally over the long term always outperform other you know major asset classes? Other equity asset classes?
I don't know if I would say they always do. I think I have seen some statistics about that, but they definitely perform at the end of a bull market, and this is the second longest bull market that we have seen in history. So we're, you know, this is kind of not unexpected to be seeing small caps start to outperform like they have the beginning of this year. So I think that's an interesting sector, and I want to make sure that people, you know, realize that it's good to diversify by having small caps in your portfolio because you can have some outperformance, particularly now we might be seeing that happen for a few years.
I think that we're nearing the end of our time. So I just want to comment because I listened closely to what Garrett, our guest, said, and he said, well, check it yourself. So I looked up this concept of sell in May and go away just on some site where they cited a Bloomberg study over the past, I guess, 20 years. That compared, had you sold in May and gone away? In other words, had you owned stocks from November to April, or had you owned stocks from May to October, right, one way or the other? Or if you just held it for the whole time, buy and hold, and didn't try to play in and out. And although there were periods when one was better than the other, the bottom line was that people who just bought and hold over the past 20 years seriously outperformed either of the other two options. So I just want to note that people who are saying, oh, I heard a great strategy, sell in May and go away, not obvious to me that that is the world's greatest strategy for investing.
Yeah, well, I don't know about the last 20 years. The last 20 years, that might be the case. But I have seen in the almanac, in the stock market almanac, that over time, the 6 months has dramatically outperformed. So I'll try and look those numbers up, too. But
I think it just depends which period you look at. That's why retrospective studies, you have to be really careful to make sure that they make sense for what you're trying to do.
Well, I think that's why you have to go back to the beginning of the stock market. You can't just go 20 years. That's the point. You have to go the full length of the stock market.
Okay. Again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, which is I just think that...
All the way back to when the East India Trading Company first issued
right.
its stock.
That's right. Just different these days. Linda's the one who doesn't even have a cell phone, right? So...
I don't have a cell phone?
No, I'm teasing. The world's different today. We're in a different world, you know? It's just not like it was back then.
And are so, you yeah. saying the market's different?
I think markets
is
are different.
Is it different this time? Isn't that the most scary thing to say ever, is the market's different this time?
I will stand okay. by when companies have good earnings. That's what you have to look for.
Well, I agree with that. Am I not the one that says that every week? Absolutely, you have to look for good earnings. I believe that totally. But I also believe that there is an element that hasn't been into the mainstream investing world, and that is cycles. And that's something that actually I learned from someone who used to be a market timer for Goldman Sachs, and he was the one that told me about cycles. And I actually don't know him in person. I saw him on television. But that's how I learned about cycles, because he was the market timer for Goldman Sachs. And my ears perked up and I paid attention when I heard that, because I know them to be a lot of things. And one of the things I know them to be is pretty good at investing.
A lot of things.
Yeah. So in closing, what do you think about the market? Is the market going to continue in a bull market for the foreseeable future? Are we headed for difficult times? What do you think, Miranda?
I think we're headed for uncertain times. I think there's a lot of unrest and uncertainty going on right now, especially with the political landscape. We're talking about a situation where, for the second time in 16 years, the person who won the popular vote did not win the electoral vote. So I think there's going to be uncertainty around there. We are dealing with, as Doug pointed out earlier, a president-elect who has never held any sort of public office and has no military experience at all. So we're dealing with a person who is unknown to this space, and we're dealing with a Congress who may or may not fall in line. Some of them have, even people from Trump's own party have expressed reluctance to fall in line with his ideas. So we're just heading into an era of a lot of uncertainty. How that translates to the stock market, I don't know. Normally uncertainty means a lower stock market, but here we are. So it's kind of an interesting time to be doing things. And I guess in the end, the real thing I have to say about, like, is it going to be a bull market? Is it going to be a bear market? When does this all end? I don't actually care because I index. So it's going to be what it's going to be. And the best you can do really is play defense with your own finances, keep your consumer debt low, make sure that you can handle what's coming your way financially, reduce your obligations, make sure you're still investing, however it is you invest, however it is you're comfortable investing, whether it's shorting this or going long on that or following trends and cycles, whatever it is that you do, look at your plan, stick with that kind of idea, and then make sure you have your backstop ready for you, whatever that backstop is. So it's really more about playing financial defense, making sure your bases are covered, and then moving forward.
Good, solid advice. Doug, what do you think? Are we at the end of a bull market?
So I think, being that my prophecy is very weak, I do think that the volatility will be increasing. So if people are going to be getting in now, and one of the things that I find funny is that my clients, this always happens when we have a big run-up and clients who are super risk-averse, they wonder why they didn't make a lot of money. And then they call me and they go, oh, I'm thinking about buying stocks now. And so I think that if you're beginning to think that, you got to realize that this could be a tough ride. But the one thing to really take note is the reason the market, I think, is going up is because ultimately people are optimistic about the policies that Trump is talking about. Now, Miranda said was very true. Will everyone fall in line and will he be able to push it through? Who knows? But certainly it seems the market supports the ideas and they're looking for a smaller government and for a better tax regime. If it happens, that's something that we have yet to see.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at P.E. ratios, they're not extremely high. I think they're sort of around the norm, around the mean. So it doesn't look super overvalued to me. But I am really concerned about the bond market. I'm very concerned about going into the cycle of rising interest rates. I'm very concerned because we have the largest debt bubble out there of all time. And I think that is something that we're going to have to be dealing with over the next few years, no matter who's president. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to fall in the next 4 years to deal with it. So I think it's going to be very interesting. And I agree, totally a lot more volatility on the upside and on the downside both. So I think we could see markets skyrocket high and then, you know, be this tremendous roller coaster where we have really deep pullbacks as well. So it's going to be interesting to see. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for an enlightening discussion. Miranda, what's going on over at Adulting TV this week?
Yeah, so actually at Adulting TV, Harlan and I recorded an episode with special guest J.D. Roth, who founded Get Rich Slowly and now runs Money Boss. And we actually talk about controlling what you can control. And I think that this is a very, very appropriate podcast episode for the times right now. You can't control the markets. You can't control what's going to happen next. So we do. We talk about how to figure out what you can control, how to take control of your life and kind of move forward no matter what is happening around you. So head on over to adulting.tv and check that out.
Awesome. Okay, Doug, what's going on with Rich as a King?
We just did a show on Rich as a King, the Rich as a King podcast, about why you can make a lot more money in stocks than in a casino. So one of the things that I've discovered is that people often think of the stock market as a casino, and I think it's a huge mistake to think of it that way. In episode 124 of the Rich as a King podcast, which you can listen to on iTunes or at our website, that's what I talk about and explain why it's not true.
Fantastic.
And Linda, what's going on with you?
Well, at Be Wealthy and Smart, we're talking about what to do with your 401k, whether to leave it at a company, move it to your new company, or roll it over into IRA account. So we're going to talk about that. So Miranda, take us home from here.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Remember to check us out at moneytreepodcast.com, where you can listen to all of our past episodes and get access to a few free resources. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and send us your questions. We love to answer them, and we will probably be doing a listener question episode relatively soon. So remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.